Welcome back to the Universalis podcast. I am Martin Kohinski, the creator of Universalis, and in this episode I'll be looking at the highlights of the week ahead, starting with Sunday the 20th of July. We all have this idea of ordinary time as, well, ordinary. It looks like a bland, uniform stretch of green vestments which starts at midsummer and goes on and on practically forever. It is just dull. I've been aware of this, of course, in planning this podcast, and I've been meditating on things to talk about just in case, for when a week comes when the days do just flow in a long, quiet river. For instance, I was thinking about expanding on some of the themes from The Creed in Slow Motion. I may still do it, but so far, against all expectation, something is happening each week. As each of these apparently slow, meandering weeks draws near, and I start thinking about it properly, it turns out to be not uninteresting at all. Look at this week. We have a bridge between the Old Testament and the New Testament, with Saints Anna and Joachim on Saturday. We have an important woman in the Gospel narrative, St. Mary Magdalene, on Tuesday. We have another bridge, this time between Gospel times and Apostolic times, with St. James on Friday. And his light, in turn, shines across history all the way to the present day. On its way to now, it shines on the 14th century and illuminates part of the story of St. Bridget of Sweden on Wednesday. Nobody thinks about St. Bridget, but that is just our ignorance. She is one of the patron saints of Europe, and she deserves it. Saturday, Tuesday, Friday, Wednesday is not the order in which we are going to live through the days of this coming week, but it is the historical order, so I'll follow it. Starting with Saturday, then, Saints Anna and Joachim fall into that undocumented gap between the Old Testament and the New. The Gospels are interested in Mary because she is the one whose consent set our whole redemption going, and because she is the mother of Jesus. So they say nothing about Mary's own birth and upbringing, but of course anyone who reads the Gospel as history and not a collection of random pretty stories is going to want to know more about this woman who told the angel Gabriel yes to the universe being turned inside out, when it would have been much more comfortable to say no, and who then went through with her yes all the way to the crucifixion and beyond. Depending on how you count it, Mary is the most important, or the second most important, woman in history. She was born, she had parents, but the Gospels don't tell us anything of this. Where there is a demand, there is a supply, and some of the apocryphal Gospels provide the facts that people want, and stories too. Apocryphal doesn't necessarily have to mean untrue. Mary did have parents. Her parents did have names. People who knew Mary will have known what their names were. Just because a fact wasn't considered important enough to squeeze into the canonical Gospels doesn't make it false. Remember what St. John said at the end of his Gospel. If it were all written down, the world itself would not hold all the books that would have to be written. I first came across Anna and Joachim when I was looking through a facsimile of a 15th century Book of Hours. The illustrators of a Book of Hours need to have incidents you can make a picture out of so that people can look at it and contemplate and benefit, and the picture I saw was of Anna and Joachim embracing at the Golden Gate of Jerusalem. The whole story is lovely. Anna is old and barren, like Elizabeth, the mother of John the Baptist, like Sarah, the mother of Isaac, and God gives her fertility. That picture in the Book of Hours shows when she has just had the news, and so has Joachim, and they meet for the first time after hearing it. So Anna's story echoes back to the early Old Testament and forward to the beginning of the New Testament. Pope Benedict XVI wrote about the Old Testament's deeply anchored theology of woman, and he said that to understand Mary one had to see the unity of the Old and the New Testaments. Here could be an example. Over and over again through the long story, as the fertility of woman keeps the people of God going, God intervenes and gives fertility to women who do not already have it, as a gift. The finite, the human, is thus kept going by the infinite, the divine. The Lord does it for Sarah, the mother of Isaac, for Hannah, the mother of Samuel, for Elizabeth, the mother of John the Baptist, and he also does it, with a variation, of course, for Mary herself. So this part of the story of Anna does fit a known pattern of salvation history. Now there is a fashion among Bible scholars to say that either you lose or you lose. If the story doesn't fit a known theme, then it is obviously untrue. If it does fit a known theme, then it was obviously invented to fit that theme. This is, unfortunately, a known disease of Bible scholars. Instead of worrying about the diseases of scholars, let's sidestep. What do we know about Anna and Joachim? That they were real people. That they were the parents of Mary. Now, whatever specialness God gave Mary at her conception, the journey from Mary before she was born to Mary on the day of the Annunciation had to be lived through, day by day, just as every human life has to be lived. And like every child, the most important steps in that journey were guided by her parents. Mary was a human being, and for all human beings, what you start out as being is never enough. It is what you grow into as you grow up and become yourself. That is important, and for that, the parents matter more than anything. So Anna and Joachim are an emblem of parents everywhere, who after more than a decade of bringing up a child, daily doing what they hope is right, not knowing what they are doing, really, sure at the back of their minds that they are making a dreadful hash of all this. At a given point they at last stand back, see the bigger picture, remember what that tiny screaming infant in the cot was like, look at her now, and realize with wonder and gratitude that it has all come out right in the end. Tuesday comes next. St. Mary Magdalene is important. The trouble with her is not that legends have accumulated round her as they did round Anna and Joachim. The trouble, rather, is that we have a lot of facts that might fit her, but we don't know which of them are hers. There are too many women called Mary in the Gospels. That is the first thing to complain about. It must have been an alarmingly popular name. More than that, there are quite a few women who are important in the story but have no name. The evangelists were busy making a coherent narrative of a story which as a whole was too important to interrupt by putting footnotes into it. When the woman breaks the jar of ointment to anoint Jesus with it, you can't interrupt, stop, go off, ask people, do your research, just so that you can proudly and irrelevantly say for certain who the woman was. But we, the readers, like to know things, and so we try to tie together some of the loose ends the evangelists didn't have time or patience for. In the West, at the height of the interest in fitting things together, there was a tradition that Mary of Magdala was the same person as Mary the sister of Martha and Lazarus of Bethany, and also the woman who was a sinner who washed Jesus' feet with her tears. The Eastern Church never went this far. I've heard the Benedictines didn't either. Lots of lovely spirituality of penitence came out of this identification of the Magdalene, but that doesn't make it true. Looking back, the idea seems to come from a 6th century sermon here, some 13th century pious ideas there. Anyway, nowadays we are sure that St. Mary Magdalene is not the woman who was a sinner and is not Mary of Bethany. We are so sure, for example, that we have turned the feast of St. Martha in a week's time into the feast of Saints Martha, Mary, and Lazarus, because we can be sure that we won't thereby be celebrating the same woman twice. This is the trouble with having such a historically based religion as Catholicism. There are things to be really lovely to believe, but we're still not allowed to believe them if they don't fit the data. And remember that after all this, St. Mary Magdalene herself still remains. She is still a person. Stripped of all the stories we mistakenly gave her, she was still present at the crucifixion. Jesus still revealed himself to her at the resurrection, and she still carried the news back to the apostles. We which sent Peter and John running to see what had happened. This is why, for example, the preface of the Mass of her feast gives her the title Apostle to the Apostles. Mary Magdalene, in other words, Mary of Magdala, was clearly a woman of some importance, some standing. Here it's worth remembering the general role of the women whom Luke calls women who accompanied him from Galilee. They weren't a swooning mass of groupies. The journey from the beginning of the story to the end of it had to be travelled the way all life has to be travelled, one day at a time, properly organised. Supplies, laundry, hygiene, it all has to be done. Someone has to do it. Someone has to have the resources to make it possible and the force of personality to organise it and make it happen. We can take St. Mary Magdalene as a prototype of the rich ladies throughout history who have seen not only the big picture but the individual brushstrokes that were needed to paint it. They have seen all the way down to the day-by-day details of doing good, whatever kind of good it might have been, and done whatever was necessary to make sure that that good was done. Mary Magdalene is one more thing. She is the woman whom Jesus freed of 7 devils. If you say you believe in devils nowadays, most people laugh at you. If you say you believe in devils nowadays, you probably laugh at yourself. That doesn't make them not be. When Jesus goes round casting out devils in the Gospels, it's often the most important thing he does, more important than any bodily healing. You can say it's all the olden days and people being stupid back then, but that's just a fantasy. What you are really saying in that case is that you don't want to think about things properly. Let's pin down a sort of picture of what a devil is. It is something that does you harm. It is something that seems to be part of you but isn't really, and when you decide definitely that it isn't part of you, that is the day that your freedom begins. And finally, at some level, to some degree, in some sense, it has a certain kind of autonomy. Imagine that you have a wart on your nose and you go to your doctor and your doctor says that the wart is part of you and you should celebrate your difference and accept yourself exactly the way you are. You kick the doctor and go and find a new one who will accept the growth as not being you and try to poison it or freeze it off without poisoning or freezing you. Instead of a wart, think of a mole on your skin somewhere that is changing shape and colour and growing bigger, and you can see an analogy of the autonomy of devils. Devils can be big or they can be little. They can be of crushing power or just a minor nuisance. Jesus has power over them. He is like a doctor. He is annoying that way. He can't, he won't do anything unless you ask. At the very least, you need to be able to say, "This is not me." In an easier case, you are able to ask for help after that. In a harder case, perhaps you can't even ask for that, but you can at least be like the man in the gospel who could do nothing except repeat, "God be merciful to me, a sinner." As long as you can say about your devils, "This is not me," even if you are being compelled to do what you do not want to do, as long as deep down there is a will that does not consent to the evil, in the long run you are safe. God's power is perfected in weakness. Coming back to Mary Magdalene and her devils, whatever they were, people in this life can go through most terrible episodes of being possessed by evil and be rescued from it, consciously or unconsciously, by prayer and the power of God. Looking at them afterwards, sometimes you want to say both, "This should never have happened," and also, "It is good that it did." They have a glow about them like the glow of Moses' face when he had just been talking face to face with God. They have been in touch with power. Somehow, whether it has been revealed just now or was given to them, there is greatness there. Mary Magdalene could well have been like that. On Friday, it is the feast of St. James. He was the brother of St. John and, like him, a fisherman. He was one of the witnesses of the Transfiguration. Like everyone else, he slept through most of the agony in the garden. He had a position of authority in the infant church. He was the first of the apostles to be martyred, being beheaded by King Herod Agrippa I to please the Jewish opponents of Christianity. He was buried in Jerusalem. That is practically all we officially know about him. In the 9th century, we learn that the relics of St. James were brought to Spain. No one is sure exactly when. The shrine of St. James at Compostela in Galicia grew in importance until it became the greatest pilgrimage centre in Western Europe. In every country there are churches of St. James and known, well-trodden pilgrim routes. In Paris, the Tour Saint-Jacques marks the start of the route, and the Rue Saint-Jacques points straight towards Compostela. In England, pilgrim routes lead from all parts of the country. Rather than pointing directly to Compostela, they point to the nearest port from which pilgrims could sail there. This brings us smoothly and logically to St. Bridget of Sweden on Wednesday, because she went on exactly this pilgrimage. It is strange how little most people know about St. Bridget. I knew nothing at all. Perhaps Sweden is beyond the range of our radar, but most ignorance is just laziness. Bridget was born in 1303. She came from a landowning family, and her father was the governor of a province. She married a suitably noble husband at the age of 13. Many of the saints' biographies of that period then relate how uncontrolled, debauched, immoral the husband was, and how the saint struggled for years to enlighten him. There is nothing of that here. Bridget's husband was a good and pious man. They had 8 children, most of whom survived into adulthood. One of them was even a saint. When she was almost 40, she made the pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela, which gives us that connection with St. James. The pilgrimage took some years. On their way home, her husband fell ill, and he died soon after they got back. At this point, Bridget gave herself entirely to the things of God. She prayed and meditated. She was given visions, which were published and were much read all across Europe. She founded a new religious congregation, the Bridgetines, one of whose outstanding qualities was that the communities took the form of double monasteries, a kind of Siamese twin, if you like, with one wing for women and another for men, with the church in the middle shared between them. Those monasteries may be one of the reasons why we like to forget Bridget. We know that women are poor, weak creatures, oppressed and needing to be liberated from their oppression. You know the story. Bridget didn't know any of this. Her double monasteries were under the rule of an abbess who bore the title of the Sovereign. All land was owned in her name. All contracts were signed by her. The monks existed to provide services to the nuns as confessors, as priests to celebrate Mass for them. This arrangement of men serving the needs of women had excellent scriptural justification, of course. Almost the last words Jesus spoke before he died were, "Son, behold your mother." And so the sons in the Bridgetine monastery existed to look after and obey and respect their mothers. The Bridgetine order had great success. King Henry V laid the foundation stone of the Bridgetine monastery of Sion House on the River Thames just upstream of London. King Henry VIII was a benefactor of the monastery before he changed his policy and destroyed everything. Later, after he had expelled the monks and nuns, he imprisoned one of his wives there for a while before executing her. A typical Bridgetine monastery had 60 nuns, 13 priests and 4 deacons, with 8 lay brothers as servants. Thus the total number of people added up to 85, in other words 72 plus 13, corresponding to the 72 disciples sent out by Jesus plus the 13 apostles. 13 not because Bridget was counting both Judas Iscariot and Matthias, but because she was counting St. Paul. The Middle Ages absolutely loved numbers and arithmetic, and it is rather charming to see this coming out in St. Bridget's rule. As well as founding a monastic order, Bridget composed a set of 15 prayers in honour of Christ in his Passion. There are various ways of using them. On high penitential days, you might say them every hour from 7 in the morning to 9 at night. Stretching across the year, you might say one a day in a repeating cycle. These prayers became enormously popular, especially as coming from the mind of such a renowned visionary. People love visions and anything arcane and supernatural. In the end, more and more promises of God were attached to the recitation of these prayers, which essentially turned them into magical incantations, so that you might recite the prayers in the same way that you might wear a lucky Cornish pixie dangling from your wrist. One promise was guaranteed paradise for whichever 15 members of your family you choose. They got even weirder after that. The whole thing had to be stamped out hard in the 1950s, and publication forbidden of any book that offered such promises. But the prayers themselves remain good prayers. They are all collected together into the second reading in the Office of Readings on Wednesday. You'll see them automatically if you are in Europe. But if you are anywhere else, then you would need to tell Universalis specifically that you want to celebrate the optional memorial of St. Bridget. Bridget did not stop after founding a monastic order. She wanted to change the world, so she travelled to Rome, where the centre of the world was. At the time, because of international turbulence, the popes had fled to exile in Avignon in France. Bridget told Pope Urban V to come back from Avignon to Rome, which he did. I say told, because from what we hear of Bridget, it is difficult to imagine her asking for anything. When Urban's position in Rome turned out untenable and he wanted to return to France, Bridget told him he would die if he did. He did return, and he did die. Bridget remained in Rome and continued to do good with her pious and charitable works until she herself died in 1373. And as a matter of history, the popes did return to Rome for good in 1376. Our modern times shed one curious sidelight on this story. Wikipedia is unreliable in various ways, but absolutely reliable in one thing. It represents the unanimous trend of enlightened, progressive opinion. And at the end of the Bridget of Sweden article, there is a list of the various ways in which Bridget was not such a good thing after all. You can summarize it like this. Bridget is severely disapproved of for being rude in the way she told people off when they were not doing right. She behaved as if she was right and they were wrong. This says very little about Bridget, but a lot about us. To be approved of, a holy woman, for us, needs to be a victim. A wet, weak, and weeping nun nobody has any trouble with. A forthright woman who knows what is right and says so is unnatural. People know better than to use words like unfeminine or unladylike, but that is exactly what they mean. You will remember that Mother Teresa, more recently, also attracted rage at her lack of feminine weakness. If these women so enrage our modern world, it is evident that we need many more of them. That's all for this week. If you'd like to write to us about anything, send an email to universalis@universalis.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Have a good week in every sense, and let's pray for one another.